Just to quickly, I guess, reintroduce myself to most of you, my name is Caitlin, and I had been working for the Fulbright U.S. Scholar Recruitment Team for a couple of years, and I just moved into a new role, still within IIE. So this is sort of my farewell webinar to many of you that I've worked with on your applications. And I'm also joined by Julia Gordon. She's our outreach coordinator, and she's probably the person, if you've been emailing in the last month or so, she's probably the person that you've been speaking with. So Julia's here today, and she's going to help us out a little bit with the question and answer session later on in the presentation. And I can see you guys have already figured out that where the questions box is. I appreciate it. As we're going through, if you want to type in any of your questions, I can stop and answer questions as we're going through, but I will save a lot of them for the end. And I already see one very good question. Will these slides be available? The answer to that question is, of course, yes. We will be uploading these slides and a recording of the presentation onto the CIES.org website, onto the webinar archive as soon as we can. And this presentation is not for students. This presentation is for faculty, professionals, artists, people that are applying via the Fulbright U.S. Scholar Program to travel overseas to either of these regions to conduct research or to teach. So if we have any students on the line, this is not the correct presentation for you. Okay, so I want to keep my part of the presentation really short, just so that all of you have a lot of time to ask your questions. But I want to quickly go over the application components and some of my best tips for you as you're putting together your application. So I'm sure many of you have already been in the online application in our new application system in Slate. So this will be very familiar to most of you, but I want to go over it just once more to make sure that you know all of the important information. So what does the application look like? It is very straightforward. And I'm going to mention page limits here today. And I was just actually told by my colleague Julia that our new application system actually will cut off your application. They won't let you upload anything that goes beyond the page limit. So if I'm telling you that there's a 3-page limit on the bibliography and you try to upload a 5-page bibliography, the system actually won't let you. So please, try to be careful with page limits so that when you're putting your application up onto the application website, you're not having any issues with uploading. So in addition to a standard form with your personal information, we ask for a 3-to-5-page project statement. And so broadly speaking, this document should address what you're proposing to do on your grant, how you're going to do it, why it is important, and what benefit it is going to produce, not only for you, but also for your host, the host country and the host institution, as well as your whole institution when you get home. It's a good idea to talk about, how you're planning to continue, sort of carrying the Fulbright spirit with you when you return home from your grant. There's a lot more guidance about the project statement, including some prompt questions for you and samples on our website. We also have review criteria up on our website that you should all be studying very closely before you submit your application to make sure you're answering all of the questions there. You'll also need to submit a tailored CV of up to 6 pages, including a publications list. I know that a six-page CV can be difficult for some people, especially if you've had a very long career. So my advice, if you're looking for ways to cut down your CV to meet that page limit, is to think about you know, where are you talking about some of these things elsewhere in the application? For example, there's a part of the application that talks about language skills and language proficiency. So you don't need to go into great detail about that in your CV because there's another part of the application where you will be including that information. And then as you're listing your, you know, articles that you've published, try to keep it to what's most relevant. You can also, you know, you don't need to include every presentation or every academic committee that you've ever served on in your career. Try to keep it to what is most relevant and most impressive to reviewers. In addition to that, there are three letters of reference that are required. If you are proposing to teach, at least one of these letters must address your teaching. So it should come from someone that's either observed you in the classroom or has, you know, taken, has reviewed your teaching reviews at the end of the year. So someone that can speak to your experience in the classroom. We also have requirements for submissions of references on our website, but I want to underscore that applicants must register their referees in the online application. References must be submitted via the online application. You can't submit a reference for someone, and we do not accept mailed-in references. I would recommend that you do this, you go into the application and register your referees. Do that early, because if you do happen to be working with a referee that has, you know, some trouble with their computer or they're you know, not great with the internet, you may need to a little bit more time to help them out and help them understand how they can click through, get the confirmation email. The email might go into their junk folder, so, you know, reminding them to check there. So don't wait until the last minute to register your references. Try to get on top of that a couple of weeks before you submit your application. If you're proposing to teach, then you'll also need to submit 2 to 3 sample course descriptions, which would be up to 10 pages total. And these would be designed by you and should be expressive of your philosophy of teaching. And you'll want to indicate whether they have been used previously for courses that you've already taught or if they're new materials that you developed for this application in particular. And we are happy to review either or a combination if you want to include one older course description and one new one that you designed, that's fine as well. If you're going to be conducting research, we'll need to see a 3-page bibliography, which is really more of a literature review but without really extensive annotations. It should reflect the current state of research on your proposed topic and would need to include articles written by scholars other than just yourself. And then depending on the award, there may be some language proficiency required. If you're planning to teach, make sure to confirm the language of instruction at your host institution as you're, you know, talking to your host about the letter of invitation, which I will come to shortly. Make sure that you are confirming with them what language you would be expected to teach in. And then for research projects, language fluency sufficient to complete the research project is required. So for applicants that don't have local language proficiency, you will need to demonstrate the feasibility of conducting your research without the local language proficiency, so in English. You'll need to demonstrate that both in the project statement and in the language evaluation form. So, you know, that means if you don't speak the local language, note in those components whether you plan to work with a translator or can feasibly complete the project using English. You know, sometimes if you're going to be working in a lab, you know, if the language, the general language that's used in the lab is English, if you just note that in your application and say, you know, because everyone in the lab speaks English, the research is done in English, local language proficiency isn't required. Or if you're going to be going out into the field and you're going to be interviewing people and you know that, you know, for example, if you're going to Israel, most people speak English, so local language proficiency for conducting these interviews is really not required. Explain that. But if you're going to be going out to, you know, perhaps a more rural area of Morocco and, you know, people are not going to speak English in those parts of the country, then you'll need to discuss, you know, I have the language abilities to do this, and here's, you know, my record of the language instruction, the language skills that I have, or I'm going to be working with a translator, or my research partner at this institution is going to be going with me out into the field, and they speak the language. So, you know, we just want you to demonstrate that you've thought about the language question and that you have a plan in place if you don't speak the language. Non-native speakers who have local language proficiency will be required to complete a two-part report. Part one is a very simple self-evaluation, and then part two asks you to register an external evaluator within the application. So this part of the report is completed by an appropriate foreign language instructor through the online application reference system, almost like a fourth letter of reference. And in terms of who would be an appropriate foreign language instructor, anyone that you have taken language courses with in your past, or if there's a language instructor on your campus that is, you know, an Arabic or a French or a Swahili instructor, and you could go and speak to them and ask them to write the letter for you after having a conversation with them about your skills. We just want someone to verify that you do have the language skills that, you know, would be needed for the grant. And if you have any questions about whether someone would be considered an appropriate foreign language instructor, you can email Julia at, I'm sure many of you have already emailed, at the Middle East North Africa at IIE or the Sub-Saharan Africa at IIE accounts to just confirm. And then there are supplemental materials that are required for applicants in the arts, architecture, writing, journalism, and other fields of that nature. So if you are an artist, or you have a career where you have had to submit portfolios in the past, then you will likely have supplemental materials that you'll want to include. And there's way more detail about, you know, what those materials are and what fields can submit materials on our website. If you are not in one of these fields, if, for example, you are a physicist, you cannot use the supplemental material section to just upload more letters of reference or some articles that you wrote. That's really not what that is intended for. It is intended for people that are in the arts to show us samples of their work. So please don't upload there if you're not supposed to. Okay, I'm just reviewing some of your questions. Okay, one question here. How many courses would you recommend submitting with a teaching award application? I assume that you're talking about how many classes should I propose to teach? And that really is up to you and your host institution. We don't have a recommended number of classes, unless otherwise listed in the award description. Sometimes the award descriptions will say teach two courses, or but if there's nothing listed in the award description, that's really a conversation for you to have with your host institution. So discuss that with them, and I would recommend that in the letter of invitation that you solicit from them, that they talk about how many courses you're going to be teaching. You wouldn't only talk about that in your project statement, but it would be something that would be good to have your host mention in your letter of invitation. Is there a course outline syllabi in the format of a course description? Okay, let me see if I'm understanding this question. Is the course outline syllabi in the format of a course description or a syllabus? It can be either. Use your best judgment. It can be a syllabi. It can just be a course outline. I would recommend that if you're going to do the syllabi format, you don't need to include all of the class policies and about academic integrity and things like that. You can kind of keep it to what is most relevant, which is they want to see, you know, what is the purpose of the course. I've also seen reviewers take a pretty close look at the selected readings and assignments, so making sure that you're choosing course readings and books and things like that that are at an appropriate level for the students that you're going to be teaching. So it's really more about the course design and the overall sort of mission of the class is what they're looking for. Okay, some questions about letters of reference. Should a host write a letter if we have not met? So your host institution cannot also write a letter of reference. The host institution can write a letter of invitation inviting you to their campus, but they cannot also write a letter of reference. So that's important. In terms of whether someone should write a letter for you, a letter of reference for you if you have not met them, that's really, you know, use your best judgment. We recommend that people try to choose people that know them and know their work and their research extensively and can really speak to their character. But if it is someone that you perhaps may not have met in person, but you are, you know, colleagues, you know, you are both in the same field and know each other's work very well, and they want to talk specifically about your contributions to the field, then that would be fine. Yeah, that is my best recommendation. I would also say that for letters of reference, to, you know, be careful about trying to choose people that you think might be, you know, with their name impressive in your field, instead of someone that knows you very well. Don't choose a big name in your field just because they're a big name, because a lot of times the reviewers, while they will be broadly within your field, they may not be experts in the very niche part of the field that you are a part of. So they may not know that this person is a big name in your field. So, you know, try to make sure that you are going with people that know you very well and can really speak to the review criteria that are on our website, instead of just, you know, choosing such and such dean because, or such and such famous scholar because you think, oh wow, that will impress people, but they don't really know you very well. Okay. Okay, I see there are quite a few more questions, but I want to keep moving because I do have some, I think some of these questions will be answered in these parts of my presentation. So moving on to the letter of invitation. So depending on the award that you apply to, a letter of invitation may be required. And so, you know, the letter of invitation is an expression of interest from your host institution. And there are a couple of requirements for letters, but broadly, you know, the format of them is really up to you and your host institution. But the requirements are, you know, that the letter needs to address what you're being invited to do, the period of time you're being invited for. It needs to be on official letterhead, and if the letter is not in English, you'll need to include an English translation of it along with the original. And then good letters will go a little bit deeper and describe the host's interests in your project, which is why we recommend that the letter of invitation come from the person that you're planning to most closely collaborate with in the country. So they will, of course, have much more knowledge about you and what you're going to be doing in the country than perhaps, you know, the dean or department chair that is not really familiar with what you're going to be would be doing on your Fulbright. But we recognize that this is particularly true in sub-Saharan Africa, that sometimes professors don't have the ability to just write letters of invitation. It has to come from higher up in the institution. So if that's the case, if you're applying to a university and the scholar you'd be working with says, I can't write a letter of invitation, it needs to come from higher up, that's fine. But I would also just let you guys know that a lot of times applicants do some back and forth with their host institution on the letter of invitation. If they send you a letter of invitation and you're like, wow, this is great, but it's not a very strong letter of invitation, you should feel free to correspond with them and ask them to add things or recommend that they add particular components to it. It's the letter of invitation is intended to be a negotiation between you and the host institution, so make sure that you are communicating with them about what exactly should be in the letter. Don't just expect them to write a letter and then be disappointed when it comes back and it's very simple. So how do you get a letter? And I would hope that at this point in the application cycle, many of you have already been pursuing the letter of invitation. But if you do not have contacts in the country that you're interested in, or the contact information is not listed in the award description, which it often is, the first place to check is in the award description to see if the emails for the person that can write a letter of invitation is already listed there. We do have some other recommendations. So first, you can use resources on your home campus, such as the International Office or talking to your colleagues. You can also take a look at our scholar directory, which lists the names, project titles, countries, and host institutions of previous Fulbrighters. So you can use that either A, as an idea, just a jumping off point to look and see where people have been hosted and reach out on your own. Or you can also try to reach out to our alumni. They're very helpful people and they've been in your position before. So if you see someone who has previously gone to the country and a host institution that you're interested in, you can reach out to them and ask them to introduce you to their contacts. And I think probably about 99% of the time they're going to be very happy to help you. And to find the contact information for these people, we don't keep that in our directory and we're not able to provide that to you. But the great thing about faculty is it's usually very easy to find their email addresses if you just Google them. It will likely be on the university website for the place that they work. So. And then speaking of Google, Google is also your best friend. Look at university websites in the host country, and oftentimes you can locate contact information for different departments right on their websites. So we do not keep the names and contact information of people at specific host institutions. So this part is going to require some hard work and ingenuity on your part. If you're having a lot of trouble with it, please feel free to email Julia, and if there are any recommendations she has, she can help out. But we really do expect that applicants take it upon themselves to pursue the letters of invitation on their own. And then, how do you submit a competitive application? So broadly speaking, the application process for Fulbright is very competitive, and therefore your proposal needs to be three things. It needs to be clear, concise, and compelling. My advice on submitting a competitive application is on the screen here. You should address the Fulbright goal of promoting mutual understanding. If you use the phrase promote mutual understanding somewhere in your application, it will be to your benefit. We also like to hear words like connections, lasting connections, collaborations, impact. Those are the kinds of buzzwords that you should be thinking about incorporating into your application. Keep in mind that the host country plays a role in selecting projects, so make sure that you're speaking to them directly and discussing why you chose to apply to their country and how your project benefits them specifically. As a Fulbrighter, you are essentially serving as a citizen diplomat, so you should also be discussing your ability to succeed in that role. Demonstrated flexibility and adaptability are also critical, particularly for applicants to these regions. While grants typically go pretty smoothly, we have seen situations in the past where applicants plan to conduct research at a particular archive, and then when they arrive, it suddenly closes for a month or two for construction. So it could happen that you would be put into situations like that. You're going to, you might face a cultural misunderstanding or run into a snag in your research plan. So we need to know that you're not going to completely lose it and run screaming back to the U.S. if anything like that happens. So talking about those abilities and any previous international experiences or other research experiences, even if they're not international, that would demonstrate that you have, flexibility, that you can adapt to different cultural situations. And then finally, impact. This is the part of the application that I think is most often overlooked, which is a huge mistake, you need to talk about the multiplier effect. What will this grant mean for you personally? What is it going to mean for your home institution when you return? And most importantly, what does it mean for the host country and the host institution? How are you planning to engage with the host community? Are you going to be doing any capacity building projects? Are you going to be mentoring faculty? Make sure that you're addressing that in your application. Even if you are planning to be doing research for 90% of the time, I would highly recommend building something into your application where you would plan to do a workshop for faculty or where you would be taking on some student researchers from your host institution to go out into the field with you or doing some guest lecturing at the university or helping to develop some curriculum for a new department or a new course. Anything along those lines will go a really long way to demonstrating the impact, and that is a very, very important part of the review criteria, so don't overlook that. And then I have the timeline up on the screen here. The most important thing to note is the deadline, which is September 16th. Then there will be a series of U.S.-based reviews where your application will be looked at by your peers, which will be people in the same discipline as you. Applicants are notified usually around Thanksgiving or December if their applications are recommended for further review abroad. If they are, the applications are batch sent to countries in question, to the State Department's Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs, and then finally to the Fulbright Foreign Scholarship Board. The time frame for notification is made on a rolling basis and ranges very widely from country to country and from year to year. If you know that there are colleagues of yours that are applying for Fulbrights, but they're applying to different countries and they hear back before you do, do not panic. It just means that we heard back on that country first. We haven't heard back on some of the others yet. So we try to notify you as soon as we possibly can, but as you know, it's to be expected with a really big program like this with so many stakeholders. We have to wait for feedback not only from the host countries but also from the State Department and the Fulbright Foreign Scholarship Board. We have to hear back from all three before we are able to send you a notification of whether you were finally selected or not. So please be patient with us and know that we will be letting you know as soon as possible. And then you would be from there, just preparing to go out on your grant, which would start in academic year 2020-2021. And the exact grant start dates will vary from award to award and are explained in the catalog of awards. Okay, so I'm now going to open up the floor to your questions. So I know that many of you already have, but go ahead and type them into the chat box on your screen. If your question is very specific to your particular case or if we're not sure and we need to follow up with the host country or another colleague of ours, we'll follow up with you privately after the webinar. But I've also listed a couple of frequently asked questions on the screen, contact information, the application deadline, and then a couple of questions that we get every year. How many applications do you get? What's the success rate? Which country is most competitive? Which country is least competitive? And we cannot answer that question. We are not able to share that information because of the Fulbright Foreign Scholarship Board policy. And then if there is a country, such as some of the ones that are listed here, like Iraq, I listed Iraq twice, Lebanon, Chad, Mali, countries that are not listed in the catalog of awards, can I still go there? No. So if the Fulbright U.S. Scholar Program is not active in those countries, they're not listed in the award description, and therefore you cannot go there. Even if you're looking at some of the multi-country awards, like the Africa Regional Research Program or the Middle East Regional Research Program, with those awards as well, you can only go to countries that we are active in. And to find out if a country is active, just take a look in the catalog of awards. And then another very frequently asked question, can I apply to two or more awards in the same competition? The answer to that is a resounding no. You can only apply to one award. And if you try to apply to more than one with more than one email address, we always find out and we ask you to remove one anyway. So only apply to one award per application cycle. Okay, I'm going to get into some of your questions. English is the official language of Ghana. How do I explain that in the application? So you would just write like you said it there. I would just, in your project statement, you can write a couple of sentences saying, English is the official language of Ghana. I plan to do all of my research in English, and there's no need for me to speak any other languages to complete my project. That's all we need to hear from you. Does the application have to be either teaching or research? Can one combine both? So that will depend on which awards you apply to, and that which are the sort of acceptable activities will be listed right in the award description, right up in the top, very top right corner. It will say activities, and it will say research, teaching, or it will say teaching slash research. So if you're able to combine both, it will say so in the award description. Let's see. Okay, so my area of expertise is applicable in more than one African country. Are the CIS staff able to identify countries that may be interested in areas of expertise beyond what is outlined in the catalog? So the CIS staff, like myself and Julia, we are not experts in the education systems of every single country in both of these world regions. So the award descriptions are written by the host countries, listing exactly what they're interested in. So your best bet is to study the catalog closely and find an award or a country that lists your specific area of specialization. Beyond that, what we expect is that applicants do their own research. Start reaching out to host institutions and see if there's a host institution that's interested in hosting your project. But we do not reach out to host countries or host institutions on behalf of applicants to see if people would be interested in their projects or if there's an interest in a particular discipline. What's in the catalog is our attempt at doing that. And anything beyond that, we would expect the applicant to do their own research. Another area that you could look is in the scholar directory. If you can search by discipline. So if, for example, you are a physicist, you can look at sub-Saharan Africa, and you can look under the discipline physics, and you can see, okay, where have most of these physics projects gone? And if you're seeing that a lot of physics projects are going to, you know, Sierra Leone, then that would sort of answer your question for you, that there's a, you know, a strong interest in those types of projects in that particular country. Can you apply when on roster for another award, like the Carnegie African Diaspora? So yes, if you are on the Carnegie African Diaspora roster or the Fulbright Specialist roster, you can apply for a Fulbright U.S. Scholar Grant. The only limitation is that you cannot be doing both grants at the same time. So, for example, if you are selected for a Fulbright U.S. Scholar Grant, while you're out on your grant, you will be sort of paused or removed from the roster because you can't, while you're on your Fulbright in you know, Sierra Leone, if the Fulbright Specialist Program or the Carnegie Program calls you up and says, hey, can you go to South Africa for the specialist grant? You can't do both while you're on one particular grant or the other. So, but there's no, you're not removed from either roster. You're just sort of put on pause. But there's no limitation applying between specialist Carnegie and the Fulbright US Scholar Program. Let's see. Okay. Okay, so some really specific questions about particular countries. One person is saying, my host wants me to do teaching at the graduate level and a collaborative research project. Is it possible to apply for a teaching/research package? So you'll need to check the award description, and whether or not you can do a combination of teaching and research will be listed in the award description. But I believe that for South Africa you can, but don't quote me on that. Can you submit more than one letter of invitation if you have multiple people that you would be working with? So this really depends, and I know that for certain countries, like South Africa, for example, or for some of our multi-country awards, multiple letters of invitation are either required or are accepted. But for most other countries, we require that you only affiliate with one host institution officially, and that you only have one letter of invitation officially. That does not preclude you from working with other people in the country, but you can really only submit one letter of invitation. You can talk in your application and say, my letter of invitation is from such and such university, they're going to be my main host. I'm also planning to work with these two other organizations, and they are very supportive of the project, but you can't include more than one letter of invitation. One thing that I will caution you about with working with multiple hosts is that it can become an issue of both feasibility and impact based on our review criteria. Feasibility is that, you know, if you're planning on working with tons of different institutions, the reviewers may see it as like, how is this person planning to coordinate and teach at all these different institutions? Or, you know, it may be a, sort of an issue of coordination and feasibility. So I would recommend, if you're going to be working with more than one host institution, trying to limit it as much as possible and explain in your application how you're going to be coordinating all of these different hosts. But it also can be an issue of impact. And the way that the reviewers often look at this is, if you're going to be in a country for 10 months, but you're planning on working with three different institutions, what is the amount of impact that you'll have at three institutions versus if you work with one institution for 10 months, what is the impact that you can have on if you're only working with them? And there, you know, the argument is often that, you know, if you're really focusing on your relationship with one institution and doing your capacity building and working with faculty and curriculum development and all of these different things at one institution, that your impact is going to be much greater than if you're trying to spread yourself sort of thin at lots of different institutions. So I would really caution you to not try to work with too many institutions. I think a lot of times applicants think like, oh, this will really impress the reviewers that I have so many contacts, I'm going to work with so many people. And it oftentimes is sort of the opposite case. So try to make, you know, don't be overly ambitious of working with too many people. Let's see. I'm going to give one to Julia so I can kind of comb through some more of these. Julia, there's a question here. Is an alternative award location required? Do you want to speak about how that works in the application?
Sure. Hello, everyone. So there is a section in the application that asks you, in the very, very rare case that for some reason, you know, the program in a certain country has to be shut down in us for a year or whatever it is. Again, this is very rare. Would you consider being considered for a different country? So I think, if I'm not mistaken, you can put up to 3. But again, this is very rare, so you it's not like you need to put together another project statement for that, if that were to happen or anything. If that were to happen and you had selected yes and put a country, you would be contacted by us and it would be kind of taken from there. But you can answer yes and you can put another country. But again, this is a rare situation, so don't count on it or anything.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Okay. Let's see. Another one. Let's see. So I have a couple of really specific questions about the syllabus, about should I include an existing grade system about how to train trainees? Am I required to submit tools such as questionnaires? That is really up to you and depends on your field. So I would say use your best judgment, but we don't have any requirement that you would include any of those kinds of things. Let's see. Okay, are there usually funds available that can be used for field activities with a host institution? So this is another question. I'm sorry I keep doing this, where I'm going to direct you to the award description. Under the award benefits tab, there will be information about whether you have a research allowance for a particular award. So that would really depend. But I do know that for certain countries and certain types of activities, there are research allowances or allowances for educational materials. That, you know, we give that to you up front and you're able to use as you think is appropriate. But for those exact amounts, you should check the award descriptions. Are recent PhD graduates in the last 3 to 4 years eligible to apply for an award if they are not currently working at a host institution, like if you don't have an employer at in the U.S.? That is perfectly fine, and there are many, many opportunities for recent sort of early career scholars and PhD graduates. I would recommend taking a close look at some of our postdoctoral fellowship awards. In the Middle East region, there are postdocs in Israel and in Qatar, but there are also a number of other countries that offer awards for early career scholars. And in sub-Saharan Africa, you can search the catalog by, you know, whether a PhD is required and what kind of person they're looking for. Read the award descriptions very closely. I do know that for some awards, which ones they are, I'm not at the top of my head at the moment, but that they will require more experience. They may require a couple of years of teaching experience, or they may be looking for a certain academic rank, would be in the case of the Israel Senior Scholar Award. So check the award descriptions really closely. I'd say that there are probably more opportunities for early career scholars in the Middle East. But there are, if you search the catalog by early career scholar, awards that are open to early career scholars, you will find many, many, many awards that come up. So absolutely you are eligible. And there's no requirement that you have an employer or a home institution back in the U.S. We have lots of people that are retired faculty or independent scholars that apply. So there's, you know, we really don't require, you would just apply as an independent scholar. Do we need financial slash logistical commitments from host. So no, you don't need a financial commitment from the host, with the exception of Israel. The financial aspect of your grant is covered by the Fulbright program. In terms of logistical commitment, you know, we don't have anything specifically that we require them to offer you. You know, what we really want them to do is incorporate you into the campus community so that, you know, you are interacting with people on campus and making connections. Oftentimes hosts will offer Fulbrighters access to an office, or sometimes they even offer housing on campus. That's something that you'll want to discuss with them as you are soliciting your letter of invitation. Some help out with transportation. Some, you know, there are lots of different ways that it's done, but that's something that you'll want to talk to them about at that point. But there's nothing that's required, particularly from a financial angle, with the exception of Israel. Okay, I'm going to do another one for Julia. So, Julia, if a discipline is not listed for a particular host country, can I still opt for that country?
So, if it the answer, which it often is it depends. So, if you're looking at an award that is an all disciplines award, that means that you can apply from any discipline. However, those awards often do have in the award description a preferred disciplines list, so you'll want to pay attention to that, because sometimes, you know, you'll find an award, and again, you can filter by discipline in our catalog, but you'll find an all disciplines award that might list your specific specialization as preferred. If, however, you're looking at an award that is not all disciplines, and again, you'll want to consult the award description to read what they're looking for, you know, that can be restrictive. So there are certain awards that are not open, that are not flexible. They're looking for, you know, for example, somebody specifically in economics or business administration. So if you're a literature person, that's not the award for you. So it's, again, one of these that you'll want to consult the award descriptions. But generally speaking, all disciplines awards, which will be in the name of the award, are open to people of all disciplines, although they often have preferred ones listed. So just pay attention to that when you're reading the description.
Thanks, Julia.
Sure.
Let's see. I'm applying to a country that has teaching, research, and combined activities. I'm planning to do something that is 90% research with some workshop-style teaching. Should I apply to the combined award or a research award with some bonus teaching? So if you are planning to do 90% research and 10% teaching, then you would want to apply for a combination teaching research award activity type. Let's see. Some questions about, can I return to a host institution the year afterwards to follow up? I'm not really sure what your question is. If you could follow up with us by email. Can you talk about dependent tuition allowance? Yes, we can. So dependent tuition allowance is available in most countries in these two regions. And the way that it works is that, you know, that there are different amounts for different world regions, but the way that it works is that we would reimburse you for the cost of sending your kids ages, I believe it's K through 12, so it wouldn't work if your dependents are in preschool or are in university. But if they're planning to come with you on your grant, they're going to be with you for at least 80% of the time that you're going to be there. and you are planning to send them to a local American school or even a local school, what you can do is you can submit your receipts to us, and we reimburse you for the cost of tuition, books, things like that. There's more specifics about that will come if you're selected for a grant, and it will be in your grant terms of what exactly is covered by the dependent tuition allowance. But yeah, that is the way it works. It is a reimbursement system. Okay. I'm seeing some questions. I may follow up with some of you just by writing, but let me see. I'm going to give another question to you, Julia. Let's see. Do you see any here that you want to answer, Julia?
I, for some reason, can't see the questions. It won't show it in my view. I'm not sure if that's because you're the primary.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay, I've got one for you. Is it beneficial or a plus or minus if you already have experience in the country that you want to go to?
So it depends on how long you've spent time there. There is an eligibility requirement that if you have spent 5 of the past 6 years abroad, you wouldn't be eligible for a Fulbright. So again, that's 5. If in the last 6 years before now you have spent 5 of them abroad, you wouldn't be eligible for the program. But if you're talking, you know, over the last 20 years as a scholar, you've spent 3 years in the country that you're an expert in and that you're hoping to go to, that isn't an issue. It's more when it reaches, you know, the limit of 5 of the past 6. If you've just spent kind of a reasonable amount of time of somebody who does research in that country, especially if we're talking the last 6 years, that's not an issue and would not be a hit against you by any means.
Awesome. Thanks, Julia. One more for you, Julia. How do I decide which award would be the best fit for me if I am the best fit for it? It says it's unclear from the website which award might be the most natural fit. If it says, what do you think about that? How should people, decide what would be the best fit for them?
So I think when reading award descriptions, if you find yourself kind of drawn to several, I would really pay close attention to everything in the award description. So does the timeline make sense for you? And will your home institution accept, you know, you to leave that month, et cetera, et cetera? That's important to consider. Does the stipend match your needs? Because that will vary by award. Are they specifically looking for your specialization? Do they have the right activity? So there's a lot to consider, but even if still looking at all of that, you still find yourself with several, you can always email us and list the awards that you're having a hard time picking between, and I'm happy to put in my 2 cents. But I think you want to pick the award that best matches your profile. So pay attention to language like scholars with at least 3 years of teaching experience are preferred. If you find statements like that where one award has one that kind of matches you better as a candidate, pay attention to that. So that would kind of be my general. And again, taking advantage of the scholar directory, reaching out to alumni. If you're between 2 awards, let's say in Ghana and Kenya, maybe reaching out to alumni in each country, hearing about their experience, that can be helpful to narrow down your search.
Awesome. That's super helpful. So a couple of you are applying for multi-country awards, and one question lists for multi-country, do I need a host institution in each country? Yes. So if you are applying for a multi-country grant, we expect you to have a letter of invitation from a host institution in each country. There are a couple of questions here that I don't know the answer to this, but Julia, you might. Let's see. This might be a question of policy, so we may need to follow up with our program management team on this, but is it allowable to have one's institution and or other grants cover any deficits in salary and the stipend from the Fulbright if it is less than the scholar's current salary? To my knowledge, you cannot ask the host institution to cover that. If you have other grants that are going to be, you're going to be applying, then you need to tell us about that so we can make sure that there isn't any duplication of funds. Julia, do you know any more about that?
Yeah, so I'm wondering if they're asking about their home institution. So, you know, let's say if you teach at Arizona State and you're applying to an award where the stipend doesn't match your salary. There are several institutions who are, you know, incredibly supportive of their faculty doing Fulbrights, and so sometimes, you know, they will supplement the whatever stipend you would get, you still get part of your salary. But that's your home institution, your current institution, not your host. So as Caitlin mentioned, it's not, you know, the University of Kenya or whatever your host is not going to be supplementing your stipend. Your stipend is from the Fulbright program, but there are many home institutions in the U.S. that, you know, many of you might work at that would be supportive financially, kind of contributing to your stipend. So perhaps that's what they're asking about. So they should get in contact with their dean or, you know, your host institution to find out about that, because that really varies.
And if it's has to do with finding other grants, how do you know much about that? Like if they apply for another grant in addition to a Fulbright grant?
Yeah, that's definitely case by case. If you have another grant and you get a Fulbright grant, we would ask you to submit kind of specific documentation detailing what the grant, what the other grant you have is covering, because as you said, we don't want to duplicate funds. But I did have a case where somebody had a grant that was for a research project that had just ended, and so while she was technically still like a grantee of this other program, it didn't interfere because the funds were not kind of overlapping. So again, if you do get a Fulbright scholar grant and you have a different grant, we'll just need to see that they're, you know, the funds wouldn't be for the same thing.
Right. And these are definitely things that, you know, we can get more details for you on, but I think are also, you know, things that will really more apply to you once you, if you're selected for a grant, that's something that you'll want to talk about with your advisor at IIE, and we can really iron out those details. I know that there's a couple of specific questions about the dependent tuition. Does it cover this? Does it cover that? I don't think Julia or I know with some of these really specific things, so that's something you can write to us about, and we can follow up those questions for you. And let's see. We're getting close to the end of our time here, but we'll try and get just a couple of more questions. Let's see. If it says research/teaching, does that mean the application should address both? Or if you are applying for teaching only, is that sufficient? So if an award says teaching/research, that means that you have to apply to do both. With the balances of teaching to research, unless it's otherwise noted in the award description, is up to you and your host institution. But if you're applying to a research/teaching award, you cannot apply to only do teaching. You would need to do a combination of teaching and research. Let's see, some questions about vacation time. Do you know, Julia, if there's like a specific amount of vacation time that they get?
I think that really varies country by country. There are, you know, certain holidays that exist in Israel and not in South Africa, so that's pretty specific. Again, you can email us directly about that, and we can always follow up with the embassy or post in that country, but that's quite specific. Sorry, don't know that off the top of my head. It would definitely vary. And it might be helpful to even get in contact with the host institution about that. They might know better, because that would be related to, like, a academic calendar. But there's not, like, to my knowledge, a set kind of standard Fulbright number.
Right. A question about host institutions and letters of invitation, if they've promised to provide all necessary support for my teaching and professional development. Is this specific enough, or does it need more detail? So that's fine. If they want to go into more detail, that's always helpful. And I think if they can go beyond, you know, some of their support for your project and talk about, and this is why we're interested in this project, here's what this person is going to be, how is this person going to be impacting our institution and why we're excited to have them on campus. That is always a benefit. Does round-trip airfare for family members require that family members be in the host country with me 100% of the time? So the level that we are looking at is 80% of the time. So they need to be on the grant with you at least 80% of the time in order to receive round-trip airfare covered by the grant. If you have a family member that wants to come for like a couple of weeks to visit you, or you know, for just a short trip, then that would not be considered a dependent, and that the airfare would not be covered. That's something that you or your family member would be required. They need to be with you at least 80% of the time. Okay. So there's a question here about the Global Scholars Program. You'll need to email globalaward@iie.org. And I'm sending that to you in a private message to talk more about the global award. So we're not going to address that here today. Let's see. Do spouses count as family members for the flight benefit? So yes, as long as they will be with you at least 80% of the time. Let's see. I'm applying for a multi-country Fulbright, but I'm using it in one country only. Will this be a negative? So I assume that you're applying for the Africa Regional Research Award. And for the Africa Regional Research Award, you do not need to go to multiple countries. You can go to just one country to do research, because most, if not all, of our awards in sub-Saharan Africa, I think with the exception of South Africa, require a combination of teaching and research. You cannot only go to research. You can go to teach, or you can do a combination of teaching and research, but most countries in Africa don't allow you to just go for research. If you want to go to just do research, and you want to go to one country, or you want to go to up to three countries, you would apply for the Africa Regional Research Award. I'm a naturalized citizen who has lived in the U.S. for the last 2 decades. Does it count against me if I have a compelling proposal but want to do it in my country of birth? So I think this kind of goes back to what Julia was talking about with your experience in the host country. What I would sort of add to it is I think that, I mean, you're a U.S. citizen, so it does not impact your eligibility. If you are going back to the country that you were born in, we see that all the time, so it is not unheard of. And I think it really comes down to how you frame it. If you talk about your previous experience in the country from a perspective of your cultural knowledge, your language skills, you know, how that is going to impact the feasibility of your project, you're going to be able to hit the ground running because you already have these connections and this experience. I'd also say that it's important to talk about some new connections. You know, I wouldn't recommend going back to the same institution that you always go back to every time you go back home. Talking about, you know, forming new connections, new people you're going to be meeting, new research, is really key. But I would say it will not be counted against you, and to really think about how you're framing it.
One thing I would just add to that is, as always, consult the award description. I'm not sure if this exists in the Sub-Saharan or MENA region, but there are some countries that if you apply and you're a U.S. and dual citizen, if you're also a citizen of the country to which you're applying to, that can disqualify you. So there are some countries, I think Spain is one, where you can't apply and be a U.S. and Spanish dual citizen. So you'll want to check the award description for that. There are other countries, like I know Israel, the postdoc award, you can't have started your PhD in Israel and apply for that award. So there are kind of particular eligibility things like that. So you'll want to just, you know, consult, like always, consult the award description under the award requirements tab, just to be extra careful that, you know, nothing will kind of affect your eligibility.
Yes, correct. And I don't think the dual citizenship is an issue for Sub-Saharan Africa or for the Middle East, to my knowledge. I'm pretty sure. So it wouldn't be an issue in terms of eligibility. It is elsewhere, mostly in Europe, I think it's an issue. And I think Japan. But I'm not sure if I'm remembering all of that correctly. Another question, this is our last question, and then we're going to wrap up. So someone is asking, if we're doing, in the award description it says there's a $3,000 research allowance for research-only grants. Does this mean that the fund is not available if you're doing teaching or teaching research? So yes, so the $3,000 research allowance is only available to research-only grants. If you're going to be teaching or doing a combination of teaching and research, there is a separate fund, which is, it's either called book allowance or educational materials allowance, and you would get that fund instead. I do know that research, if you're doing research only, the stipend levels happen to be slightly lower than they would be if you're doing a combination of teaching and research. So I think that in the end, it ends up balancing out pretty well. One more question. I think this is about flex. Please duration question continuity. So if you're asking about how flex works, so you can only do flex if it says in the award description that the flex option is available. If it says flex no, then you can't apply for a flex award. And the way that flex works is that you can either go over one continuous grant segment, or you can split up your grant into multiple shorter segments over over one or two consecutive years. So if you're asking, can I go for 1 week every few months? No. And it says all this very specifically in the award descriptions, that the minimum grant length is 1 month and the maximum is 3. So you could go, for example, you could go for 2 months in the fall of 2019 or 2020, and then you could go for 2 months in the spring of 2020, or you can go for 3 months and 3 months, or you can go for 1 month and then 2 months. There's a lot of different ways that you can do it, but the minimum grant length is at least 1 month, so you cannot, and you can only go on 2 to 3 different grant segments. You can't go, you can't, example, go for 1 week 10 times. That doesn't work, and there's a lot more detail about exactly how flex works, the specifics of what is permissible in the award description. So I would recommend, the follow-up to this is you do not have to reapply it each time. If you are applying for a flex grant, you're applying for a flex grant, and then, you go from there. You don't have to reapply to the Fulbright program each and every time that you would be going out on a new segment. So I'm glad we cleared that up. All right. Well, I don't have anything else to add. And we have gone a little bit over our hour here today. So if we weren't able to address your question, please email Julia directly at the Middle East North Africa at IIE, or, and I can pull those up on the screen really quickly so that you can, if you want to take a screenshot, it is on your screen now. You can email her with more information, and she, you know, can take your questions by email. Or if it requires a follow-up phone call, she can do that as well. We will be archiving this webinar, hopefully in the next couple of days. So if you're interested in listening to the full presentation again, or sharing it with your colleagues, or just having the slides for your personal use, it will be available to you. If you visit CIES.org and you kind of scroll down a little bit on the homepage, you can go to webinars and it'll pull up our webinar archive. So, Ken, thank you so much. I hope this was helpful for everyone. And on behalf of IIE and the Fulbright U.S. Scholar Recruitment Team, we just want to thank you so much for taking the time to be with us here today and learn a little bit more about the program. I hope everyone has a fantastic rest of their day. Bye, everyone.